Hey, everybody, and welcome to The Brand Called You. Listen, I am so excited about today's guest. Dr. Bandy Lee is a forensic psychiatrist and a world expert on violence who became known to the public by leading a group of mental health professionals in breaking the silence about our past president's dangerous psychology and publishing a New York Times bestseller called The Dangerous Case of Donald Trump. 37 psychiatrists and mental health experts assess a president. She has taught at Yale School of Medicine and Yale Law School for 17 years before moving over to Columbia and Harvard. She served as director of research for the Center of Study of Violence, co-founded Yale's Violence and Health Study Group, and her clinical practice consists of psychiatric services at maximum security prisons and in state hospitals. She's also the author of a second book called Profile of a Nation, Trump's Mind, America's Soul, which is the perfect place to start. Bandy Lee, welcome, with America's Soul. Because what has your you came to my attention after your first book, but your later publications, the words that you've used, the sentences you've used have really shaken me up. You have referred to the state of society's soul in America today as a death spiral. And I'm traumatized by that expression, but I think it's accurate. And I guess I would love you to articulate what you mean by that.
Yes. First of all, thank you for having me, and thank you for bringing attention to this issue. What I was referring to as a death spiral is actually kind of a call for attention to this problem, because what people are simply accepting as ordinary politics or just an ordinary state of society, for me, from a medical professional's perspective, is actually a very dangerous state that could spiral, as you mentioned, to our demise. And that is the state of pathology. So I don't see things in through the lens of left versus right, Republican versus Democrat. I see things in terms of health versus disease. And the difference is that when things are coming from a healthy place, no matter the ideology, no matter one's political party, it will be life-affirming. But when it comes from a place of disease, and as a mental health professional, I recognize things from the perspective of mental health versus mental disease, it can become very dangerous. And in fact, by definition, disease brings us to destruction and death. And that is what I am referring to. It doesn't mean that we are in an inevitable course. In fact, pretty much all of medicine is to find out the dynamics that are happening so that we can reverse course. And that's what I'm trying to call attention to.
I mean, the thing that I responded to most about your work was that you really are looking at things from a mental health, a physiologic perspective. You worked with prisoners, with murderous prisoners, and you saw similar parallels in their mental state than you did to our former president. And what sort of frustrates me continually is that when I see you interviewed, no matter how many times you say this is a mental health problem, this is deeply organic, that it's fueled by something that is beyond cognition, people always say, but why can't he just make another choice? And I think the thing that I'm really interested in here is what happens with an ill person, such as, what I consider. I mean, I understand you've not properly diagnosed our former president. But I want to understand the pathology of narcissism and this kind of pathology. I want to understand what kicks in, for example, when Donald Trump loses an election. What is losing to somebody who shares that pathology, is losing the same thing as death to them? Is there a primitive mechanism that kicks in that causes this behavior that is beyond his control, is what I'm really curious about.
Yes, what you mentioned about narcissism or any kind of personality pathology is that that it does cause one to regress to usually an earlier state of development, and so it is a more primitive mechanism. And although I haven't diagnosed because Donald Trump as an individual is not of interest as much as his effect on society. And I have always deemed him a public health problem. So in fact, even in the introduction of my first book, The Dangerous Case of Donald Trump, which was published in 2017, I stated that he is a public health threat, and that our interest in him is not as an individual, but because of his harm, potential harm, and now effectuated harm to society.
Well, so you talk about a public health threat, and I think part of that threat is the way this particular mental disease spreads. And you've talked about it. You said in some ways it can spread faster than COVID. I think I've even heard that fascism is not a political problem, but a mental problem. And I'm very curious, how is it possible that one person's pathology can be so potent that it can be absorbed by and continued by an entire society? What happens from a sort of mechanistic point of view? How does that happen?
Well, it reveals that our minds, our psychology, is not confined to the individual, that we are actually psychosocial, and that there was a grave danger of having such a mentally impaired person in such a powerful position with lots of public exposure, that his pathology would spread. This phenomenon has been documented and studied since 150 years ago. It's been termed different things, but it's been called, people are most familiar with folie à deux, or in English, it's been called shared psychosis. Now it's been termed induced delusions or induced symptoms, in that when someone of severe symptoms is not intervened with and is highly exposed to healthy individuals who are relatively isolated, that is, they don't have to be physically isolated, we have learned, but emotionally isolated with him through immunizing them or causing them not to believe other sources of news, not to engage with others who with different beliefs, then we're pretty much isolating them with an individual with his pathology. And what we observe in the family setting, in cults, in gangs, street gangs, and even in a nation, is that when we have such a severely impaired person who is dominating the conversation, then the other people take on those symptoms as if they had the primary illness themselves.
Do other people also take on delusions in the same way?
Yes, delusions is actually one of the most common symptoms that they take on. And even the most bizarre delusions, I've seen this a lot because I've worked in public sector settings, in state hospitals or in prisons, where individuals often go untreated and their symptoms become quite severe. And we see it's very dramatic in that an entire family can take on bizarre delusions when a dominant member has schizophrenia, for example. They come to take on very bizarre delusions. And these were previously healthy individuals.
I wonder what the mechanism, there must be some primitive survival value in taking on somebody else's delusions. Like, for example, the election was stolen, for example. I kind of fully believe that Donald Trump believes it. I believe he actually believes it. I don't believe he thinks he's lying. But what fascinates me is why the recipients of that information take it on. And I wonder, do you have any idea what, was there some sort of value primitively for us that, you know, at some point changed? Do you understand my question?
Well, did we change? What we find with the phenomenon of shared psychosis is that as long as the exposure is maintained and essentially the symptoms are maintained through that exposure and their tight emotional bonds, that it, once you remove the offending individual, that is the primary source of these symptoms, from the family, from the community, and hospitalize them, that the remaining individuals return to normal. As to what exactly is the mechanism, it's actually not as well known, but there are several different ways in which the symptoms appear to spread. In other words, there can be synergy between individuals of the same disorder. So it just looks like that the symptoms were transmitted, but they're actually strengthening what they originally had. The second possibility is that the secondary individual had some predisposition, such as personality traits that would make them more susceptible to taking on these symptoms. The third possibility is that they were previously healthy, and yet the situation, the circumstances have allowed them to take on the symptoms. And that is perhaps the most surprising of this phenomenon, is that when you put a severely mentally ill person together with a healthy person, it's not the healthy person who influences the one who is ill, but rather the one who is ill who induces the symptoms in the healthy person.
And rather quickly,
that's how strong and powerful these symptoms are, and the emotional drive behind them is so powerful that healthy persons are often unable to resist. Healthy or a weaker person, all the more so. And finally, there's a type where one resists for a very long time and finally converts. And that's thought to be the most difficult to turn around after the exposure is removed.
I mean, you must have seen this as well in a very small level in the prisons that you've worked in, right? With dangerous prisoners, have you seen their effect once surrounded by peers within a prison system?
Oh yes, it happens quite commonly. In fact, I would say it almost happens in every gang, in every street gang, because they depend on notions that detach from reality, such as that they, what they're doing is correct and honorable and good, and advances a cause to serve their leader, usually, and it depends so much on tight bonds, emotional bonds that they were not able to form with family, with society, that their identity revolves around this this group being honorable and righteous. Even if it's breaking the law, they're actually doing so for whatever greater cause they have. And that structure is put in place, then you kind of convince yourself that you're outside of the rules of society, and so then you depend so much on the leader of the group that you take on their symptoms. And these being dangerous individuals, they often have severe symptoms that they do transmit.
So, but you do give me hope in a sense that what you've been saying is there is hope for America to recover from this mental disease. Is removing the primary disease, primary infector necessary? But what about the sub infections, namely the people that have taken on leadership roles? Is that as potent, or maybe you can articulate that?
Yes, of course. There are three components, I have said, that are involved in this kind of contagion. I've been calling it the Trump contagion, as shorthand. First is you remove the individual, the offending agent, which is the individual with a primary illness. And in this case, it would be Donald Trump. And by removal, I mean remove not just from an office, but from the public sphere. Remove his exposure and his influence.
So, like right now, he's being slapped on the wrist for, his behavior after, with what he's saying about judges. But what you're saying is it really has to be full removal, full exposure removal.
So this kind of contagion. This kind of contagion, I've been calling it Trump contagion for shorthand in this situation. There are three conditions for it. One is you have to have an offending agent, that is the primary individual who is spreading the symptoms. Then you have receivers of those symptoms, that is individuals with vulnerable psychology or who are emotionally bonded with the primary individual and isolated them from the rest of society. And that goes into the third condition, which is the overall environment that predisposes people to this kind of contagion. And so what you need to do is to intervene from all three levels. So I have often recommended, first of all, it's important that we remove Donald Trump from the public sphere. And we saw some of that effect when he was initially removed from Twitter. There was actually a drop in his popularity. People thought it was maybe his COVID management or maybe after the January 6th insurrection. We have seen that it's not the insurrection itself. People have gone right back to supporting him. But that brief period when he dropped in popularity was because his exposure was diminished. And now that he has reestablished his exposure and come back into campaign, and all these legal procedures, he actually is he knows his influence on the public, that he continues to present himself and appears in public, sets a narrative. So all this is allowing this to continue. The second factor is his audience, the people who are vulnerable to him and adhere to him no matter what. They've been conditioned in a way where they will not be swayed by any matter, including criminal indictments, four indictments, over 90 charges, and yet they still continue to support him. And that shows the power of the mind, that the mind can almost convince oneself of anything. And so intervening with them in the sense of giving them other places to go. In other words, they're truly, what they're really looking for are a place where places where they will be accepted, affirmed, and where they will have an identity. So in fact, in family settings to or community settings, in order to bring one out of a gang or a cult is by extending one's friendship and interaction with a person, not simply dismissing them and cutting them out of your life. And that's usually not done by confronting them, but extending an emotional openness to them. The third factor is intervening with the environment. Now we have an environment where disinformation and Donald Trump's lies, you said that you truly believe he believes them, and they may have started as a lie, but he is so emotionally invested and emotionally in need to believe these lies that he ends up convincing himself. And when he does convince himself, yes, they do become delusions. And the way that we can assess whether or not they are delusions is also in the speed and power with which they spread. Because symptoms, because of the emotional drive behind them, the compulsion that drives these beliefs is often call it mass hysteria. People are almost in a frenzy in their belief, and they will defend that belief or the beliefs to their death. And that also comes to show the power of the mind when it's convinced of something, when it is absolutely in need to persuade oneself of something, then it becomes unrelenting. And this is far more powerful than the ability and speed with which we engage people rationally. So the way to tell apart ordinary popularity from the spread of symptoms, something much more ominous and destructive, is by the speed and strength of the spread.
You know, the thing I don't understand is, you've been extremely clear. It's very obvious this is a mental health issue that is driving. Why are we so resistant to acknowledging that this is a mental health problem? Why do we continually assign some level of control to Donald Trump? Like he can make any other decision but this one. Why, as a society, are we willing to say Biden is physically too old, but not that Trump is absolutely mentally crazy? In other words, what happened that we have, you know, dropped the ball on mental health issues in this country? Do you have any idea how that happened?
Well, that relates to the death spiral I've been speaking of. After a certain level of symptoms, we become self-destructive and we aid the advancement of pathology rather than making healthy choices. We were not always this way. In the very beginning, in fact, I was invited to all news programs, every prominent program I was invited to, be it network or cable. And I was actually quite impressed that there was no barrier whatsoever because the topic was mental health. I thought there would be a certain level of stigma. There wasn't. And in fact, the news organizations and producers were quite admirable in calling the right expert for the right issue. We became the number one topic of national conversation within 3 months of the book being published. And it was a national instant New York Times bestseller, the first of its kind, as many have noted. And because we were multi-authored, presenting specialized knowledge. And yet, we came to this day of we're being completely invisible in the public's eye because of the intervention, I believe, of the American Psychiatric Association, because the shift was dramatic. I went from interviewing 15 hours a day without a break every single day to one or two interviews and then nothing within weeks of the American Psychiatric Association coming out and spreading disinformation that what we were doing was unethical, whereas in fact, it is said in their own code of ethics that we have a responsibility to patients as well as to society. And this is one of our primary responsibilities to society, to alert the public and educate and inform when there is danger to society. In fact, it's in the Geneva Declaration, the universal physician's pledge, that has been made since the experience of Nazism. It's thought to replace the Hippocratic Oath, and it was instituted since 1948 by the World Psychiatric, World Medical Association, and World Psychiatric Association, that if, especially if there is a destructive regime that is threatening humanity, physicians have an obligation to speak up. It's not a choice. It's an obligation.
And yet they misquoted the, I believe it was the Goldwater Rule, and they censored you. And do you have any inkling as to why?
Well, many have said that it was funding related. They're largely funded by the federal government. In fact, dozens of members, even officers, resigned when the APA came out with this faulty reinterpretation of the Goldwater Rule with the Trump administration. It was within less than 2 months of his being inaugurated that they came out with this unheard of interpretation of the Goldwater Rule. None of the scholars of the rule agreed with it. And in fact, no one would have thought of that this obscure rule that hardly no residency program, as far as we're aware of, has been teaching the rule, and it was thought to be really antiquated. It was based on one lawsuit, not against a clinician, but against a news agency, a tabloid magazine, in fact. Whereas most ethical guidelines are based on scholarship. And if lawsuits that are numerous, hundreds of lawsuits, for example, form the basis of the duty to war and to protect, that if there is a danger to even one individual, we have a duty to warn and to protect that individual, breaking all rules of confidentiality and all other guidelines in order to protect life. And that is the prevailing principle of everything we do in every single encounter we have with an individual as a patient or even out in the street in public, because if someone is posing a danger to others or the public, the person becomes our patient. We actually don't even have a choice not to intervene in that situation. But in the case of Donald Trump, well, it's interesting. They said, you can't say anything about him because he wasn't your patient, and you haven't examined him and gotten consent. But
sorry, I'm losing you. I lost you for a second. Can you just say?
On the other hand, what they have said makes no logical sense, because on the one hand, they said you cannot warn the public or inform society of the dangers it was facing because Donald Trump is not your patient. You haven't examined him, and you haven't spoken about you haven't gotten consent to speak about it. And on the other hand, duty to warn or duty to protect society does not apply because you don't have a responsibility to society. So their purpose was to pull themselves out of this situation when they should have been the ones leading the way in fulfilling this societal responsibility that every medical professional has, and of course every psychiatrist.
I don't want to end this interview without asking you what you're working on now, because I know that these principles that you have and your incredible bravery in speaking up is not just limited to the Trump factor. So I'd love to for you to share with people just a little bit about what you're passionate about these days, in addition to the Trump factor.
Yes. Well, of course, as you've alluded to before, the Trump factor has grown into a far greater problem than just him. And that is exactly what we've been warning against since the very beginning, that it was not an issue about an individual, that his psychological dangers would become cultural, societal, civic, and geopolitical dangers. And those are the dangers that I am working on now, that there are societal conditions that have given rise to him. Of course, he has spread the dangers exponentially since being in the office of the presidency and threatening to be in the office of the presidency once again. Of public health, and I'm invited to co-found a violence prevention institute with other luminaries in the field. But I'm also on my own project of how to intervene and work on these issues outside of institutions, because our institutions have failed us. The American Psychiatric Association failed us by doing exactly what it was not supposed to do, abusing its authority with the public to misguide it into greater dangers. My own home institution and alma mater, Yale University, failed me in terms of curtailing my academic speech, putting out public disinformation as to my position there and my role there, when in fact I have helped erect programs from scratch and in some areas helped catapult them to national status and international status. And yet, even in the midst of all my evaluations being of top caliber, not just satisfactory, but in fact the best, my students and fellow faculty have evaluated me to be of the highest caliber. And yet, based on public disinformation and based on public speech, they were allowed to terminate my appointment. And so, which has disillusioned me, because I left other institutions, including Harvard, in order to join my alma mater, thought they were acting on principle and according to the standards of that I essentially expected them to protect academic speech. They came out and said outright that they had no obligation to protecting academic speech. Then where does that leave us as society? When journalists and intellectuals are silenced in society, that is actually a very frightful time, because the voices of knowledge, the voices that affirm facts and the best available knowledge that we have, are the first to be suppressed in a time of authoritarianism. And I think you quoted me in stating that fascism is not a political ideology, but mental pathology in politics. And that is when there's the mental pathology of being unable to accept reality, having to advance a different narrative than what the facts and established knowledge tell us. And so I'm still figuring it out, but I'm trying to find a way to acknowledge that, but a basic psychological state of health for society, which touches upon the state of our soul as well, in order that such dangers to society do not happen, and that we are able to rescue ourselves from this death spiral.
Well, the state of my soul feels a lot more confident now that I know that you're out there fighting for all of us. I really think you're a visionary. You remind me of the Greek chorus, and you know that it will only be a matter of time where we come back and completely recognize your contributions in major ways. I portend major appointments to major institutions back again for you, all sorts of books. I can't thank you enough for your work. It's helped to illuminate for me the distinction between, you know, mental health issues and other issues. And it's helped me to understand what is driving what. And it's given me just tremendous insight, as it has so many people. So I can't thank you enough for your work.
Really, well, mental health is basic. In order for us to do everything else, just as we need a basic level of physical health to carry out physical activities, we need a basic level of mental health.
Yes.
Rational functions.
We do. Well, thank you, Bandy Lee, so much. And I wish you all the continued success with all of your work. Thank you so much for today. I appreciate it.
Thank you very much.
Okay. Bye-bye.
My pleasure.
Thank you for listening to The Brand Called You videocast and podcast, a platform that brings you knowledge, experience, and wisdom of hundreds of successful individuals from around the world. Do visit our website, www.tbcy.in, to watch and listen to the stories of many more individuals. You can also follow us on YouTube, Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter. Just search for The Brand Called You.